Iran's foreign minister says Tehran supports any kind of agreement between Lebanese political parties to elect a new president. Palestinian Islamic Jihad movement says it will coordinate with Lebanon's Hezbollah to counter potential attempts by Israel to assassinate resistance leaders. And sporadic gunfire is reported from the Sudanese capital Khartoum as African nations try to extend a ceasefire between the warring generals. Warm welcome to our studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is News. Thanks for joining us. Iran's Foreign Minister Hossein Amri Abdollahian says the Islamic Republic will support and respect any decision by the Lebanese on electing their president.
We encourage all Lebanese sides to speed up electing president and the political process in one of the important regional countries. We support any kind of deal between Lebanese sides and call on all foreign countries to support the Lebanese people's decision without interfering in Lebanon's affairs.
Amri Abdollahian made the remarks in a joint presser with his Lebanese counterpart, Abdullah Bouhabib, in Beirut. The top Iranian diplomat said that he discussed a number of bilateral and regional issues with Bouhabib, including the Iran-Saudi normalization deal, the situation in occupied Palestine, Libya, and Sudan. For his part, the Lebanese foreign minister welcomed Amir Abdollahian while stressing the positive impact of Tehran-Riyadh rapprochement on regional issues. The Iranian foreign minister is on a second leg of a regional tour. He's scheduled to meet other top Lebanese officials. Our Beirut correspondent Mariam Saleh says Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian has been actively trying to help diffuse tensions and to help with the political process in Lebanon.
Well, this is Minister Abdollahian's fourth visit, actually, since he's been in office to Lebanon specifically. So we can see how active Mr. Abdollahian is when it comes to trying to help out Lebanon, especially in its crises and its economic fallout. Of course, we only have his statements that we heard last night, Thursday night, upon his arrival at the Beirut International Airport, where he was met with members of parliament, representative of the parliament speaker, also representative of the foreign ministry, and several other members of parliament, in addition to several members of the Union of Muslim Clerics, who all actually made short, concise speeches lauding the Iranian role in Lebanon when it comes to the assistance, the continuous social assistance that they have given to Lebanon, especially in its socioeconomic crises. And the fact that we also heard from one of the members of parliament stressing undoubtedly that had Lebanon been accepting, as an official Lebanon, I mean the governmental stance, had it been accepting of more initiatives from the Islamic Republic of Iran, then Lebanon would have been in a different situation.
Iran has reacted to what it calls Germany's interventionist approach following a court verdict against an Iranian-born German national convicted on terrorism charges. Foreign Ministry spokesman says such a stance is not only an attempt to prevent justice, but to encourage terrorists and promote terrorism all over the world. Nasser Kanani was referring to the German foreign minister's statement that condemned the Iranian court ruling and called the verdict unacceptable. Kanani added that Tehran expects from those claimed to be fighting terrorism not to seek to reward terrorists for their bloodshed. He further described Berlin's intervention as a prominent example of human rights violation. On Wednesday, Iran's Supreme Court upheld the death penalty for Jamshid Shahmad, leader of a U.S.-based terror group, Tondar. He was convicted of committing terror attacks and operations against the Islamic Republic. A court in Tehran has ruled that the U.S. must pay millions of dollars in damages to the families of the victims of two simultaneous terrorist attacks in Tehran that happened back in the year 2017. The verdict says the U.S. is to blame for the loss of lives of plaintiffs' loved ones, as well as the physical and emotional injuries. Gisumi Shahmadi reports.
The Judiciary's International Affairs Department, following upon a lawsuit filed by the families of the victims of the 2017 terror attacks in Tehran by the Daesh terrorist group. Deputy Chief of Iran's Judiciary announced the verdict on Wednesday. According to the court ruling, the United States government and nine individuals and entities, including former U.S. Presidents Barack Obama and George W. Bush, retired U.S. General Tommy Franks, the U.S. Central Command, the U.S. Treasury Department, the CIA, as well as Lockheed Martin Corporation and American Airlines, must pay $9.95 million in compensation for financial damages and $104 million for moral damages, as well as $199 million for punitive damages, with the fine totaling around $313 million. The court cited statements by high-ranking U.S. officials about the country playing the main role in organizing and directing terrorist groups, particularly the role of the CIA in creating terrorist groups, including Daesh.
We unleashed fury all over the Middle East, and it was a terrible mistake. And then Obama came in, and normally you want to clean up. He made a bigger mess out of it. He made such a mess. And then you had Hillary with Libya. So sad. In fact, in many respects, you know, they honor President Obama. ISIS is honoring President Obama. He is the founder of ISIS. He's the founder of ISIS. Okay? He's the founder. He founded ISIS. And I would say the co-founder would be crooked Hillary Clinton. Co-founder, crooked Hillary Clinton.
On June 7, 2017, Iran's parliament and the Imam Khomeini Mausoleum in the capital, Tehran, came under terrorist attacks. Four gunmen disguised as women entered parliament and opened fire on security guards there. And separately, gunmen attacked the Imam Khomeini Mausoleum, opening fire on the people inside the compound. At least 17 people were killed and nearly 50 were injured in these attacks, which were later claimed by the Daesh terrorist group. The Wednesday ruling is based on complaints filed by families of three people killed and six wounded in those attacks. This comes as a number of U.S. court verdicts over years have ordered compensation to be paid from seized Iranian assets to victims of various incidents worldwide, including the September 11 attacks. Gisumisha Ahmadi, Tehran.
Senior Islamic Jihad official says the Palestinian resistance movement has a deal with Lebanon's Hezbollah to coordinate in response to potential attempts by Israel to assassinate resistance leaders. Walid al-Qatati made the remarks in relation to reports that the Israeli regime has embarked on its assassination policy against Palestinian officials. He said the resistance takes the current dynamic employed by the regime seriously. Qatati said the Palestinian resistance remains integrated in confronting Israel. The Palestinian official said the resistance is not to give in. Israeli forces have conducted numerous raids into the occupied West Bank in recent months. More than 100 Palestinians have been killed so far this year. The U.S. and several African nations are trying to secure an extension of a ceasefire between Sudan's army and a paramilitary group as sporadic gunfire continues in Khartoum. The U.S. Secretary of State and the chairperson for the African Union Commission discussed creating a sustainable cessation of hostilities in Sudan. Earlier, Sudan's top general, Abdel Fattah al-Burhan, gave his initial approval to extend the truce, which is due to expire on Thursday midnight, for another 72 hours. He also agreed to send an army envoy to Juba for talks following a joint initiative by South Sudan, Kenya, and Djibouti. The response from the paramilitary rapid support forces remains unclear. More than 500 people have been killed since the fighting erupted in mid-April. The World Health Organization has predicted more deaths because of shortages of food, water, and medical services. Several nations have already evacuated their citizens and diplomats from Sudan. The government-funded Australian think tank says Western countries are losing the global technological competition against China. The Australian Strategic Policy Institute, in its latest research, finds that China has become the world's leading science superpower. According to ASPI, China has established a lead in high-impact research across the majority of critical and emerging technology domains. ASPI's new critical technology tracker, which examined 44 technologies, found that China is now leading in 37 of the examined technologies, overtaking the U.S. According to the findings, China has particularly excelled in defense and space-related technologies. ASPI is a nonpartisan think tank that produces expert advice for Australian and global leaders. The institute was established by the Australian government and is partially funded by the country's Defense Department. A new report by civil rights organizations says hate crime in the U.S. is likely to spike ahead of the 2024 election day. The Leadership Conference Education Fund says FBI data shows an unmistakable pattern of a rise in hate crimes during general elections. The data suggests that from 2008, when Barack Obama, the first black American president in U.S. history, took office, hate crimes have been on the rise. The report says hate crimes have nearly doubled since the year 2015. It says a staggering spike came during and after Donald Trump's election campaign, and it has not returned to the levels before the Trump period. The civil rights group suggests that black people and Muslims are the main targets of hate crimes. Russian forces have pounded Bakhmut, a city in the eastern Ukrainian industrial region of Donbas, which remains the focal point of their attempts to capture for months. The general staff of Ukraine's armed forces said fighting gripped Bakhmut and nearby areas, but Russian forces failed to advance on two villages there. It said at least a dozen localities came under Russian fire. Separately, a spokesman for the Ukraine's forces in the region said that Russia, using artillery and multiple rocket launchers, targeted the area more than 300 times. According to Russia's private military group Wagner, Ukrainian troops are now pouring in ahead of what it called an inevitable counteroffensive. Meanwhile, the governor of the southern Ukrainian region of Mykolaiv said that Russian missiles hit an apartment building, leaving one person dead and 23 others injured. The administration of U.S. President Joe Biden has reportedly expressed concern that if Ukraine's spring offensive against Russia fails, it will spark criticism at home and in European capitals. The U.S. government says the potential failure will weaken support of Washington's allies for the war against Russia. The Ukrainian offensive, which is expected to take place next month, is reportedly aimed at retaking territories most likely in the east and south of the country.
For weeks, there have been a lot of talk about Ukraine's much-discussed counteroffensive against Russia. U.S. sources say Ukraine is preparing to launch a counteroffensive against Russian forces as early as next month. But it appears that Ukraine's planned military assault, originally announced for November 2022, has been postponed indefinitely. The administration of U.S. President Joe Biden is quietly preparing for the possibility that Ukraine's spring counteroffensive would fall short of expectations. The counteroffensive will attempt to retake territory, most likely in the east and south. Publicly, President Joe Biden's team has offered unwavering support for Ukraine. Pentagon documents allegedly leaked by Airman Jack Teixeira revealed that the U.S. doesn't believe Ukraine can regain any significant territory in its counteroffensive. More current assessments also don't expect much Ukrainian success. The Biden administration officials have reportedly said they don't think Kiev has the ability to sever Russia's land bridge to Crimea in the Kherson and Zaporizhia oblasts. U.S. intelligence says that Ukraine simply does not have the ability to push Russian troops from where they were deeply entrenched. Now, the administration is expected to face criticism from hawks who believe Biden hasn't given Ukraine enough weapons, as well as those who have been calling for the U.S. to push for diplomacy. Without a decisive victory, Western support for Ukraine could weaken and Kiev could come under increasing pressure to enter serious negotiations to end or freeze the conflict.
While every hour on the battlefield counts, the delay in supplying long-range missiles to Ukraine is already significant. This does not allow us to roll back the positions of Russian terrorists, in particular from Kherson, Zaporizhia, and our other cities, which are constantly shelled by Russian long-range missiles.
According to leaked Pentagon documents, 12 Ukrainian combat brigades of about 4,000 soldiers are expected to be ready at the end of April. But some military experts say three or four Ukrainian brigades could realistically be trained and armed by the U.S.-led NATO military alliance. Some U.S. officials believe that Ukraine's shortcoming proves that it cannot force Russia out of its territories completely.
A
American and NATO allies have supplied Ukraine with extensive artillery and ammunition for the upcoming battle. But Ukraine has no guarantees of success with a counteroffensive against Russia, despite receiving Western weapons, training and intelligence support.
Yes, still there is some disagreement, but I'm sure everybody will understand that we are in a situation of extreme urgency. I'm sure that in the following days we will reach... But while we look for this legal agreement, don't believe that we are just sitting and waiting. The whole work is going on. The whole work is going on. So once the legal agreement will be reached, the work, the practical work, will be finished.
According to reports, a large portion of the combat-ready, equipped and motivated cadre units of the Ukrainian forces have already been destroyed. U.S. military officials have said Western countries had managed to prepare 9 armored brigades, but experts have questioned this figure since over 830 tanks would be needed for that size of a deployment. Some experts say no more than 3 or 4 Ukrainian brigades could realistically be trained and armed by NATO and the U.S.
I said in Kyiv yesterday that Ukraine's future is in the Euro-Atlantic family, and all NATO allies have agreed that Ukraine will become a NATO member. But the main focus now is, of course, on how to ensure that Ukraine prevails.
Ukrainian officials have said their goal is to break through dug-in Russian defenses and create a widespread collapse in Russia's army. But American officials have assessed that it's unlikely the offensive will result in a dramatic shift in momentum in Ukraine's favor. Since the war began last year, the United States has discouraged peace talks and recently came out against the idea of a ceasefire in Ukraine. But now there is a discussion amongst administration officials about convincing Ukraine to accept more modest goals and agree to a temporary ceasefire. A top-secret assessment from early February stated that Ukraine would fall well short of its counteroffensive goals. More current American assessments are that Ukraine may make some progress in the south and east, but won't be able to repeat last year's success. Kyiv has ruled out negotiations with Moscow until it recaptures all the territories. But even with all Western help, big gains are not guaranteed or even necessarily likely.
The UN Human Rights Chief has urged the British government to reverse legislation that calls for clamping down on protests. The legislation gives police in England and Wales more powers to act to prevent major disturbances. The Conservative government believes the public order bill would keep a small minority from disrupting the lives of a wider public. The bill creates a new criminal offense for those who seek to lock themselves to objects or buildings. The bill has drawn heavy criticism from civil rights groups who say it gives police too much power. UK Parliament passed the bill on Wednesday. And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight. Russian tycoon says that dollar has 5 years left as dominant currency. Sanctioned businessman Oleg Deripaska says the greenback has been used as a weapon of retribution for way too long. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. According to RT, the US dollar has only 5 years left as the principal currency for the global economy, according to Russian billionaire Oleg Deripaska. He claims the greenback superiority has for way too long been used as a weapon of vengeance against all dissenters, and often without prior legal evaluation. 7 years ago, the absolute dominance of the greenback in global settlements and financial transactions seemed unshakable. The founder of aluminum giant Rusal wrote in a Telegram post recently. Deripaska expects global settlements to become more diversified and for digital currencies to become more compatible. He said, "That will be hard at the beginning, but then the world will discover a new reality without a need for a hegemon." Recently, U.S. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen admitted that Washington's unilateral sanctions on countries around the world could undermine the hegemony of the dollar. However, a year ago, she claimed the opposite, saying that the greenback didn't have any serious competition and was not likely to for a long time. Earlier this month, Ivan Chebeskov, who leads the Financial Policy Department at Russia's Financial Ministry, said that interruptions and difficulties with international settlements became the most painful consequences of Western sanctions for the Russian financial system. He also highlighted that at the same time, the problem had inevitably triggered an increase in settlements in alternative currencies. In February, the Central Bank of Russia created a special department for handling issues arising in international settlements. The new body deals with the challenges that have become particularly relevant in the context of sanctions, such as the transition to settlements in national currencies. Deripaska is among many Russian businessmen sanctioned in the past year by the U.S. in response to Moscow's special operation in Ukraine. He was forced out as CEO of Rusal after Washington targeted the company's aluminum exports. He's worth $2.6 billion, according to Forbes. Meanwhile, Press TV noted U.S. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen has admitted that economic sanctions used against countries by the U.S. put the dollar's dominance at risk. As the United States has continued to weaponize the dollar, countries are seeking alternatives from creating new common currencies to using local currencies. Nations are trying to find a safe and equitable way to trade instead of being at the whims of a hegemony that can decide overnight to confiscate a country's money or cut it off from the international financial system. Russia launched its de-dollarization policy when the West slapped economic sanctions against the country. After Russia launched its special operation in eastern Ukraine in February 2022, the U.S. led a massive wave of financial sanctions against Moscow. Press TV noted the biggest moves were the decision by the West to freeze nearly half of Russia's foreign currency reserves and also the removal of major Russian banks from SWIFT, an interbank messaging service that facilitates international payments. The backdrop of the sanctions introduced by Western regimes against Russia, a major global energy producer and exporter, prompted China to decide to ditch the dollar in international trade as well. Bank of Russia records show that the Chinese yuan has become a major player in Russian foreign trade. India, a major importer of Russian energy, has also taken several steps towards shifting away from the greenback to rubles and rupees in mutual trade with Moscow.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuhal ladheena amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis sabri was salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu Alaikum. Now it's time to listen to a short speech by Sayyid Muhammad Rizvi.
أما بعد فقد قال الله سبحانه وتعالى في كتابه الكريم إن الله يحب التوابين ويحب المتطهرين. الحمد لله, we have covered in our discussion on the topic of Tawbah, five discussions starting with the reality of Tawbah, the crucial role of Tawbah in our salvation in the hereafter. We also talked about the first Tawbah in the human history and also the procrastination and the problem of delaying the Tawbah. And last night we talked about the issue of the conditions for acceptance of the Tawbah, especially when it comes to Huququl Ibad and Haqqullah. Tonight I wanted to talk about the levels of Tawbah. You see, when we talk about the levels of Tawbah, we have to first understand the levels of sins. Coming to the second, level of sin, spiritual one, a spiritual sin, this is what I would say that, a righteous person would feel that this is beneath my dignity or self-respect. It is not expected from me to do this. Although, legally, shar'i, fiqhi, it's not a zim, it's not a dham, it's not a sin. Yet I would not do that. And there are two levels of that. One we call the akhlaqi sin. It is not a sin from the fiqhi point of view. If a person commits that, he is not going to be punished. For example, when we talk about certain things which are makruh, if a person commits a makruh deed, is he going to be punished? How do we define makruh? Haram, yes. If you do haram, you'll be punished. A lesser level of prohibition is makruh. Makruh just means that, if you do this, you lose the sawab, the reward. It has an impact, but it's not considered to be a sin. There is no punishment, neither in this dunya, nor in the hereafter. But it would have an impact on the person. At least, if nothing, then he loses in the grace and the sawab of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And so this is one level of the sin which we call the akhlaqis, level. Then there is even something beyond that. And that sin is neither fiqhi nor akhlaqi. It has to do with the world of law between Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and those who are close to Him, His awliya and muqarribeen, anbiya and the a'imma we are talking about. That relationship of hub and love which is between these chosen ones and Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is such that they are so much, you know, submerged deeply into the love of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala that because of their human nature, being members of the society, interacting with people of all different kinds, including, interacting with munafiqeen, that takes away what we call, you know, full attention and focus on Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. It's not that they are doing anything haram or even anything makruh. Rather, some of the actions that they do as far as interaction with the people is concerned is for Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. But they are, at that moment, with the people. That tawajjuh, that focus, that attention of that muhib with the mahbub, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, becomes lesser. And at that moment, the wali of Allah will say, Astaghfirullah Rabbi wa atubu ilayh. When you hear the tawbah of Amir al-Mu'mineen or the Imam, is not because of anything, you know, fiqh sin or even akhlaq sin. It is actually the demand of that deep love that they have for Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. You know, if you look at, for example, the munajat number 13 in Sayyif al-Sajjadiyya of Imam Zainul Abidin alayhi salatu wa salam, where he says, Ilahi astaghfiruka, Wallah, I seek forgiveness from you. For what? Min kulli lazzatin bighayri zikrak. For any pleasure, and which was not haram, neither makruh, absolutely jais. But he says, oh Allah, I ask your pardon for every pleasure this which was devoid of your zikr and remembrance. وَمِن كُلِّ رَاحَةٍ بِغَيْرِ أُنْسِكْ. And all Allah, I do istighfar and ask your forgiveness for every comfort that I went through where you are not close to me the way I should have been closer to you. That uns, companionship. وَمِن كُلِّ سُرُورٍ بِغَيْرِ قُرْبِكْ. And Allah, I do istighfar for every happiness where I was not closer to you. He was close, but he felt that I should have been even more closer. And this is where our ulama have come with a term called Hasanatul Abrar Sayyatul Muqarribin. The good deeds of the righteous people is considered to be sins for those who are closer to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. The righteous people are expected to do the wajibat, to do the mustahabbat, to refrain from makruh. Haram is out of the question there. These are the abrar, the good people. But when those who are closer to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, if they limit themselves to that level, for them it is a sin, because they are expected to be at a higher level. And so when we see these words of istighfar and tawbah coming from the words of the masumeen, this is not on that level of the sin which is fiqhi or not even akhlaqi. Look at the dua Arafah of Imam Hussain alayhi salatu wasalam. Sometimes it is just the glory and majesty of Allah that they know. We can't even comprehend that. The way they know Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, the way they glorify Him, there also they realize that whatever they do to glorify Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, to praise Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, it's not to the level. And at that time, that wali of Allah, who is closest to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, feels that I have not done enough. And then you will see they will say istighfar and tawbah, not because of committing any sin. You know, you look at the dua Arafah, Ya man albasa awliya'uhu malabisa haybatihi. Imam Hussein alayhi salam, his father of Zainul Abideen, he says, oh, the one who covered his awliya, those who are his friends, with malabisa haybatihi, with this awe and majesty of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. They come to realize that greatness and majesty of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. فَقَامُوا بَيْنَ يَدَيْهِ مُسْتَغْفِرِينَ. And at that state, those who are the awliya of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala stand up in His presence to do istighfar, because of that majesty and glory of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Again, Imam Zainul Abideen, the munajat which are there at the end of Sayf al-Sajjadiyya is also in Mafatih. Munajat number 12. Ilahi qasurat al-alsun an bulugha thana'ika fama yuliqu bijalalik. O my Lord, tongues fall short of attaining praise of you according to your majesty. We cannot even comprehend the greatness of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. وعجزت الأقول إن إدراك كنه جمالك. Intellects are incapable of grasping the core of your beauty. And then at the end, ولم تجعل للخلق طريقا إلى معرفتك إلا بالعجز عن معرفتك. And oh Allah, you have not assigned the creatures any way of knowing you the way you should be knowing, but just to realize that we are incapable of knowing Him the way He is. And that level is the level where even a wali of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, O Allah, I praise you, but I have not done what you deserve. And therefore they will do tawbah and istighfar.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahi Karimun Adi Alimun Hali Hakimun Mati.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
The in the limelight.
According to Britain's Centre for National Statistics, 77% of British adults over the age of 16 feel they're very worried about the rising cost of living. Of these respondents, 50% said they worry almost every day. We take a look at some of the world media and press's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. The Yorkshire Post has covered this story and tells us more. A survey from one leading UK youth charity found that half of young people in London have had their mental health negatively impacted by the cost of living crisis. The polling from UK Youth, which was carried out on 16 to 25-year-olds in Greater London, also revealed a number of concerns around loneliness, home heating and access to food. UK Youth is focused on supporting young people in the United Kingdom with an open network of more than 8,000 youth organisations and nation partners. Britain's cost of living crisis refers to the fall in real disposable income since late 2021, caused by a number of coinciding factors, such as the war in Ukraine and ongoing economic problems following the COVID-19 pandemic. The chief executive of UK Youth, Ndidi Okezie, OBE, said, "These figures must be a wake-up call for our country. Our young people are struggling in the face of the cost of living crisis and they need help." She added, "Youth organisations who provide essential support to young people are also on their knees. The situation cannot be allowed to continue as it is." A separate UK Youth survey found nearly two-thirds of youth organisations, or 63%, are seeing increased demand for services from young people, with a similar figure, 67%, facing increased operating costs. According to UK Youth, more than 8 in 10 young people, or 82% in London, are concerned about the impact of the cost of living crisis on their ability to get a secure job now and also in the future. More than 8 in 10 parents, or 84% of parents in Britain, worry that the cost of living crisis will impact their child's future, with almost 3/4 of those concerned, 74%, believing better or increased access to youth work would help. UK Youth, which launched a new £5 million grant fund last February in partnership with Piers Foundation to support youth organisations through the cost of living crisis, is calling for greater government investment into young people in Britain. Code 7 Limited is one youth organisation to have been awarded a grant of £17,000 a year for 3 years by the charity to help it cope with the cost of living crisis. Its chief executive officer, Peter St. Aubin, said, "We're doing our best to support as many young people and young families as possible, but council services are shrinking and people need us more than ever." He added, "One mother told us the other day that one of her child's socks went missing in the wash and she can't afford to buy a new pair." He said, "It seems like a small thing, but to a child who can't go to school in matching socks is a shocking indication of where things are." Martin Spears, director of the DOST Centre, which has been awarded £8,300 a year for 3 years by UK Youth, said, "We spend twice what we used to on food to accommodate the growing numbers," he said. "We're also seeing more and more young people coming to us, which means more staff and more resources are needed." UK Youth claims there has been a decade of cuts to the sector, with local authorities spending 77% less on youth services. a £1 billion real terms decrease, leading to the closure of several hundred of youth clubs and the loss of thousands of highly skilled youth work jobs. The charity, Dorset Centre, is urging the government, together with local councils, businesses and community funders, to guarantee quality youth work provision for young people across the United Kingdom. Britain's national broadcaster ITV Television Network has also covered this story and tells us more. A new survey found vulnerable young people are struggling to keep their lives on track because of rising cost of living. Figures show 55% of people surveyed in the northwest of England are worried about eviction due to increased cost of living. And three-quarters said they're struggling to afford the basics, including food, heating and travel. Jason, not his real name, is a 20-year-old who lives in Manchester. He has been surviving on benefits and says he regularly goes without food and heating because he simply can't afford the basics. Jason has to use the shower at his uncle's house most days as it costs too much to use at his own flat. He hates having to do this as he feels he's a burden on his family, and a constant struggle to make ends meet has affected his mental health, making him withdrawn and depressed. He says this has all come about because of the cost of living crisis. The cost of living is so much more expensive these days. There are thousands of young people in the United Kingdom who are unable to pay for their basics and are at risk of becoming homeless because they cannot afford their rent. Simone Newman from DePaul, UK said, "We're witnessing the effects of the cost of living crisis daily. What's so worrying is the huge threat to the futures of young people across the northwest of England, especially those trying hard to rebuild their lives after homelessness. If a young person can't make ends meet, they risk eviction and the devastating possibility of returning to homelessness." Simone Newman said, "We cannot allow this to happen because out there they are exposed to increased risks around criminal exploitation, poor mental health and loss of hope for a better future. We urgently need donations to cover the increased costs to support young people experiencing homelessness." Turkey's Anadolu News Agency has also covered this story. Britain's Chancellor of the Exchequer, Jeremy Hunt, said, "We must continue with our efforts to drive down inflation so we can ease pressure on families and businesses." Jeremy Hunt claimed, we are on track to do this. With the OBR forecasting, we will halve inflation this year and will continue supporting people with a cost of living support worth an average of £3,300 per household over this year and last year, funded through windfall taxes on energy profits. DePaul have launched an appeal to raise money to help young people in crisis. The Office for National Statistics, ONS, said recently food inflation in the UK hit a 45-year high of 19.1% in March. The latest inflation report revealed that food and non-alcoholic drink prices saw their highest rate of inflation in over 45 years, up from 18% per year in February. The cost of food alone surged 19.6%, with notable increases in the prices of bread, cereal, meat, fish, milk, eggs, olive oil, vegetables and fruit. Bread and cereal prices jumped a whopping 19.4%, while meat prices were up 17.4%. Whole milk prices rose 37.9%, while egg prices climbed 32%. The price of olive oil ballooned 49.2% compared to last year due to supply disruptions caused by the war in Ukraine. Additionally, vegetable oil rose from 19.3% and fruit prices rose 10.6%. The Office for National Statistics, ONS, said that the last time food prices were this high was back in August of 1977, when inflation was estimated at the time at 21.9%.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1930 to 2030 UTC on the following frequencies. 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz for Southern Africa. And FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and IntelSat 39 and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.
Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood ghodde saratani Israel mukhalifim.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of a speech delivered by the leader of the Islamic Revolution in a meeting with a number of poets and experts in Persian literature in the Imam Khomeini Hosseiniya on Wednesday, April 5, 2023. The meeting took place on the eve of the auspicious birth anniversary of Imam Hassan alayhi salam. Da'bil al-Khuza'i recited his famous poem in Khurasan, and Imam Rida alayhi salam rewarded him with a jubba. Jubba is a long outer garment. Well, Da'bil left and went to Qom. The people in Qom told him, "We have heard that the Imam has given you a jubba. Give it to us." Da'bil said no. They kept insisting and asking him to give them a piece of it, but he refused. He left Qom with a caravan. Along the way, bandits, those who attacked caravans in the desert, came up to their caravan, stopped them, and took all their belongings from them. The chief of the bandits sat on top of a large rock above them, while the bandits were busy opening the bags of the caravan and taking their things one by one. As he was looking at his agents, he recited this verse, أرى فيئهم في غيرهم متقسما وأيديهم من فيئهم صفرات. The theme of the poem was that he was saying, I see that I am losing what is mine and that which belongs to me. The chief of the thieves was referring to the caravans. In other words, he was saying that they had lost their belongings. Their wealth was in someone else's hand. This was a verse from the ode that Ni'mal had recited.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Nabil told his caravan to go and ask him, the chief of the thieves, who that poem was from. One of the people in his caravan went to him and asked, who is this verse, the poem that you recited from? He said, it is from Da'bal. The person told him that Da'bal is here. Where? He asked. They showed him Da'bal. Da'bal went forward and said, yes, this is my poem. I'm Da'bal. And the chief of the bandits ordered them to return everything they had taken from the caravan. What I want to say is that this is the meaning of media. This poem, for example, was recited in the month of Rajab in Khorasan. A thief memorized it in the month of Sha'ban, and he recited a verse from it as an analogy. This is how poems were circulated and spread. It was a form of media. The media today is different, of course, but poetry has its own place. No other media has that special effect that poetry does. Of course, some forms of media like the cinema and probably more influential than poetry, visual media and the like. But they finish and are forgotten. You watch a movie once, you want it twice, and it finishes. But poems remain. They remain for 1,000 years. This is a characteristic of poetry. Therefore, poetry is an effective, long-lasting medium.
Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.